arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Bonjour!
Bonjour!
Welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I am Janelle.
I am Vicky.
Oh, very good.
I was trying. There was a point in time where I was trying to learn French from like an app, and I.
Yeah. Muzzy? Was it Muzzy?
It was not Muzzy.
I know. Comment allez-vous? Je m'appelle Janelle. That's my name is Janelle.
I know Amelie du fromage.
Amelie du fromage from Dexter, obviously. Je suis la juvie.
Fêche la vache.
Oh, yes.
I think that's fetch the cows. It's a Monty Python thing. Fêche la vache.
What? Fêche la vache. So, hints for what's happening. Welcome.
Oh, my God.
We're gonna podcast.
Yeah, this will be a fun one. I'm actually kind of excited. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know the story that I'm covering. I kind of hope you don't because I don't know too much. Really fun.
Out of
it's
this
really
place
fun.
That we're gonna talk about.
Yeah. So this will be a really fun episode for me at least. Very light.
Nice. Mine too. Mine's very light.
After last week, after last episode, we need something to pick us back up.
Right.
You know, bootstraps and things.
Sure.
Yes. So on that note, let's head over to the newsroom. Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. So a couple weeks ago, we talked about, or a couple episodes ago, it might have
been. How the world was falling down around
us.
Yes.
No, we talked about, if you remember, two police officers who ignored a call to catch a Snorlax on Pokemon Go.
That was a long time ago.
Do you recall this?
Yeah. Okay. That was more than 2 weeks. It was a very long time ago.
I said a couple episodes. So, Lewis.
Did they go to Pokemon jail?
No. Well, maybe. Lewis Lozano and Eric Mitchell, this is an incident in 2017 where they decided to ignore a call for a request for backup to a robbery at a Macy's, instead spending the next 20 minutes trying to catch a Snorlax on Pokemon Go, which if you're none
it's the rarest.
Unfamiliar.
It's not.
Unless it was a shiny maybe, but.
They never are. They just take a lot of balls to get.
Hey, Pokeballs. If you're unfamiliar, Pokemon Go is a Pokemon game where you travel to, it's like an ARG kind of. Mm-hmm. You travel to various locations in order to catch Pokemon. You know, gotta catch them all.
Pokemon Go to the polls. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Fucking stupid.
Yes. So
I hate everything.
After this incident, they were fired.
I'm shook. As the kids say.
And this was in California. So they were fired. The board found that they were guilty on multiple counts of misconduct based in part on a digital in-car video system recording that captured petitioners willfully abdicating their duty to assist a commanding officer's response to a robbery in progress and playing a Pokemon mobile phone game while on duty. Okay. So that was April 15th, 2017. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They have since appealed the decision. Okay. They were arguing that the city violated the law by using the police car's digital in-car video system recording as evidence and by denying them protections of the Public Safety Officers Procedural Bill of Rights Act. So they're basically like, we're cops, we're protected.
That's why they put cameras and everything to watch you.
Mm-hmm.
So, no.
So, the decision to hear the case or to hear the appeal was denied.
Good.
I'm glad. They are pretty much agreeing with the original.
Nice try. Fucker.
The original there was also, and this is all from NPR, they were accused of making false statements about their lack of response and their involvement with Pokemon Go.
I don't catch them all, okay?
Quote, for example, they said that they were only talking about the augmented reality game rather than actually playing it.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, like, the cameras caught them talking about it, but not actually playing it. So, anyway, the appeal was denied. They are, does not appear to me like they're going to be getting their jobs back.
Good. Fuck them.
yeah. There's, like, this whole long article. Anyway, wanted to give an update. We don't follow up on all these stories, but honestly, I keep seeing this one come up because it is so unusual. Like, for a cop to
most
just...
Most of the time, they'd be well, like, yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, to not respond
2 weeks paid vacation.
Yeah.
Paid what?
Yes, right. Okay. We are going to move on to Netflix and Kill. This week is a little different. It's not as crimey as you would think. Far more culty, I would say.
I'd get down to cults.
We're talking about The Deep End on Hulu. Because Teal Swan. Man, she's a piece of work.
If you want to listen to like a really, really good in-depth coverage of her, Someplace Underneath is a podcast that did like a fucking million parts on her.
Okay.
It's really good.
I was actually going to mention, so before we dive into The Deep End. I would actually suggest listening to the podcast The Gateway by Jennings Brown. It was done via, I wanted to say it was Medium, but I don't think that's right. Anyway, so Jennings Brown did this podcast that looks at sort of Teal Swan and her journey into becoming a pseudo cult leader.
Swindler? I mean, what?
And he was actually like an executive assisting producer on The Deep End. They kind of like based it on his podcast. But The Deep End itself, it's a Hulu documentary, Hulu original, 4 episodes. Mm-hmm.
The way they ended it, I was like, is there more?
No.
Confused.
Mm-hmm. So it looks at Teal Swan and sort of her empire, I would say. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's not really like a name for them, I think, but other than like the Teal Tribe.
Yeah.
But Teal Swan is essentially a guru, I would say. She's a sort of spiritual leader that talks a lot about self-improvement in a very visceral, in-your-face kind of way. That
like a really fucked up Deepak Chopra.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very, I don't even, it's so weird to me to try to describe it because it's a lot of blame. Like,
yeah.
To me, like, it's like.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. It's like, well, if your life is not good, it's because you're doing something to fuck it all up.
Mm-hmm.
And she is very brash like that. I mean, she uses a lot of language that is not typical, I think, of what you would consider from like spiritual leaders.
Yeah, especially because a lot of the things she says has been basically like telling people to kill themselves.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. So part of the reason I included this, one, because we do talk about cults and sort of their effect on people. But also there is this question of whether the things she said has encouraged people to commit suicide that were her followers. I want to say she has not been convicted of a crime. At this moment in time, she has not been convicted of anything, and we will not definitively say yes or no, but
she has been investigated several times.
She has been investigated. Interestingly enough, in the documentary, they hire their own private investigator to look into them, who definitely, spoiler, concludes they're leaning towards cult.
Yep.
But she does use a lot of language to the effect of,
straight up asking someone, well, why haven't you killed yourself? Yeah,
if you want to kill yourself so badly, why haven't you done it yet? That type of thing, which I would say to the normal person definitely sounds like encouraging suicide.
Yeah.
But again, she has not been convicted of anything. I'm saying this to cover our asses because I feel like even with our tiny little podcast, she's kind of litigious and would go after that shit. So definitely worth a watch. There is a lot of talk of suicide. So, like, beware for your mental health sake.
Big trigger. Mm-hmm. Child sexual abuse,
yeah. Recovered memories. Like, she deals a lot with recovered memories.
Yeah.
The documentary itself was filmed over the course of 3 years while they were given access to her. I actually found out in a later interview with Jennings Brown that the 3 years were actually, like, the COVID years.
Mm-hmm.
So, she has this retreat in, like, the Caribbean somewhere. It's like one of these like off like out of the US type of retreat places mm-hmm. where people will go for like a week intensive thing. Yeah. But they were not doing that at the time. This was actually like at her house. Mm-hmm. It also catches the group in a really interesting time of transition mm-hmm. when one of their main
inner circle
people leaves. He was with Teal for 18 years. They had previously dated and they were together. Yeah. And he filmed all of her videos and did a lot of manager type things. Mm-hmm. And then he got married and things kind of spiraled very quickly. All of this is on film.
Yeah, because Teal hated his wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was threatened.
Yeah, it took. It's so funny. This is one of these instances where I'm watching this and I'm thinking, as a person, like if you were Teal Swan and you watch this, I already know what her reaction was, mm-hmm. but you watch this and you think, man, I look like a real fucking asshole. Maybe I should reevaluate how I deal with people. Her response was, release all of the footage. They edited this to make me look horrible. But I'm like, no, you just are horrible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's a lot.
Yeah.
But I was very anxious when this came out. It's beautifully done. Mm-hmm. I think it's filmed in a very like cinematic way mm-hmm. with these kind of like montages and like overlays of things from the past and the present and like... I don't know. I thought it was really good. Thoughts? Do you want to?
I mean,
do you have anything?
Yeah, there was one part where they were dipping the woman who kept telling everyone that she was going to kill herself and she's tried to kill herself multiple times into the water for that stupid cold therapy treatment. That part was a little excessive.
It's supposed to like simulate drowning, I think, is the idea.
Because that's what happens when you drown in cold water.
Yeah, it's a thing.
So.
Yeah. Very weird. There's also some like medium type stuff, like talking to the dead type stuff.
Mm-hmm. They didn't really go into that very much.
No, they had one little scene with that guy and Blake's wife, mm-hmm. where she like channeled the guy's mom or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that is like also a part of Teal Swan's thing is like this sort mm-hmm. of contacting the dead stuff. So
yeah. And she said that her parents absolutely hated her because she was so fucking weird because she saw all these things. And I'm like,
yeah.
Or were you just a terrible person from the jump?
Yeah. And she has had some abuse things in her past. Mm-hmm. Not to invalidate that. Like,
but often abused go on to become abusers. So.
Right. So I would say check it out. Check out The Gateway. Check out, what was the name of the podcast?
Oh, Someplace Underneath.
Someplace Underneath. Make up your mind for yourself.
They're on the last podcast network.
Okay. She's definitely like a polarizing figure. Mm-hmm. Check it out and make up your mind because this is, I think, a group that we'll have to watch in the next couple of years. Like,
oh, yeah. Right there with Jared Leto's cult. It still keeps happening.
Yeah. I'm surprised those two aren't like super friends or married. Right? Maybe they are. Not married friends, but
yeah.
Yes. Friends. This is that part of the show where you could say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. This might actually not apply.
Yeah, I don't think it applies.
Not for me, but this is going to be a fun one.
Unless you're, not ready to hear some Americanized French accents.
Oh, God, yeah. Sorry, France.
Sorry, all of France. In advance. But not really.
Yeah.
Not really. France has been, been pretty terrible.
Yeah.
They've done some terrible things, too.
Jill.
Colonizing.
What are we talking about today?
Because, again, I just don't want to fucking be here. We're just going to go outside the U.S. Take a fucking trip to France.
Yes.
We're talking Frenchy crimes.
Yes.
Like I said, prepare yourself for terrible mispronunciations, horrible accents, going wee-wee too much.
Wee-wee.
Wee-wee. Ha-ha.
Ha-ha.
Twirling of mustaches.
Baguette.
Yeah, right. Croissant.
Croissant.
It's Macron. My name is French, unfortunately.
Pizza. Oh, wait, that's Italian.
Yeah. Vicky, have you had real French wine before?
I'm going to say probably not.
You know that whole, like, not. It's not champagne unless it comes from the Champagne region.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely like kind of don't spend over, like, $20 on wine. And that's when I'm getting real fancy.
Yeah, yeah. So I used to have a lot of money.
Didn't we all?
When I didn't own a home.
Yeah.
And I've tried like real French wines before. Mm-hmm. They're all right.
It's wine.
Honestly, I like Italian wine better.
Yeah.
I prefer a Prosecco to a champagne. Crucify me. I know.
Yeah. I mean, Prosecco's good.
Prosecco's great.
Fucking good.
But I'm not like a huge wine drinker. You know, I don't like it dry. You know, lots of French wine is very dry. Yeah. Not a big fan.
Not big into red.
I don't like the tannins. I don't like hard tannins.
I don't know what that means.
That's what makes it like better and dry is there's more tannins in
What's a tannin?
It's a element within the wine that happens after it's been fermented.
Oh.
So.
It's not like an ingredient. It's just like the name of the
flavor. Yes, it is a natural flavor. Process. Yes.
Gotcha.
We're going to butcher this. So if you're a wine drinker, turn this off immediately.
Yeah. This will be fun.
If you know the fancy terms, you don't want to hear this.
Yeah.
So we're going to deep dive into a scandal that's befallen one of France's most popular wine producers out of Burgundy.
Okay.
You're familiar with Burgundy
wine. I am, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the Domaine de la Romanée Conti. Or the DRC.
Nice. That's pretty good.
You're welcome. Now, we're going to get a little history on the vineyards so you can understand why this is confusing.
Okay.
Vineyards are like monopolies of land in France.
Yes.
That's the way I can put it. The vineyard was part of an abbey in 1232. Run by monks, but of course, as was the thing back then, it eventually got sold out. if you're not familiar, monks are the reason we have wine.
Yes. Yes.
In 1631, it was bought by the de Cronenberg family, who renamed it Romanée. By the 1700s, the Cronenberg family decided to sell, and a bidding war between Madame de Pompadour, mistress of Louis the Ninth?
11th? Roman numerals.
One of the fancy French ones. 14th.
Hey.
France. And Louis-François, Prince of Conti.
Okay.
As you can imagine by the name it is called now, Louis-François won, and the name was changed to Romanée Conti.
Okay.
So his ownership was very short-lived. That's because all of the Richie's land started being seized during the Revolution. Hell of a time to buy a vineyard.
Oh my God.
The vineyard would flux and shift for decades as land was leased, sold, and then sold back. Domaine de la Romanée Conti remains the largest vineyard in Burgundy's region today,
okay.
Producing one of the rarest wines, which is its flagship Burgundy.
Wow.
It was described by a wine critic, Clive Coates, as the following. Quote, "The scarcest, most expensive, and frequently the best wine in the world, if you can lay your hands on a case, and that is a big if, you would have to pay 5,000 euro or more for a young vintage, double or triple for a wine in its prime. This is the purest, most aristocratic, and most expensive, intense example of Pinot Noir you could possibly imagine. Not only nectar, a yardstick with which to judge all other Burgundies."
Oh my God.
Barf.
So pretentious.
Oh my God. This is why I don't drink wine. Because of people like that. I'm just like, I'm not even going to drink it.
Give me a Moscato.
Yeah. I was a bar back for the museum I worked at for a minute when we did like an event. Mm-hmm. And I could not get this like stupid old wine screw cork thing to undo. And I was like, this is fucking stupid. And the woman's like, you must not drink wine that much. I was like, no, I find it very pretentious. And then she like just went blank as a sheet of.
Yeah.
And just walked away. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, bye.
It has nothing to do with the rusty fucking corkscrew you gave me to work with.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But also the exact type of person that would be at exactly. like an art gallery yes. mm-hmm. drinking fancy ass wine.
Wine's pretentious.
Yeah.
So the vineyard produces roughly 500 cases annually, which really amplifies its rarity. DRC's Romanée Conti 2005 was released in 2008 for $3,650 to $4,300 a bottle, depending on where you were. At retail, it now ranges between $8,000 to $16,000. Just last weekend, actually, Christie sold 6 bottles of Romanée Conti at an auction in New York for a record high of $26,000 per bottle.
Jesus.
Oof. So, you know, some wine fans, I would say fans, not connoisseurs, because they are insane, actually have jumped the vineyard walls to get cuttings of the vine so that they could try to produce their own wine.
Oh, my God.
Which is why that whole, like, it's not champagne unless it comes from the Champagne region is a thing.
Yeah.
Because people will cut things from vineyards or take seeds and grow them in other places and produce wines from these vines and say that they're the same thing, but they're not.
Yeah.
But they are.
But they are.
So you could see how something so rare and so sought after could become a crime. Right?
Wine, yeah.
So we're going to talk a little white collar crime and a little bit of sabotage.
Okay.
And we're going to look at for it. Not one, but two scandals that have rocked this little old winery.
Okay.
So we're going to go back to 2010, only 12 short years ago. California Girls by Katy Perry was just coming out on the radio, and that was the first iPad year.
Okay.
So, do you feel old?
Was it 2001?
2010.
10.
The first iPad.
God, that seems like it seems like it's girls. Been so long ago.
Right?
I guess I do feel kind of old.
I felt very old when I read that it's the year the first iPad came out. I was like, ew. So, France was doing its thing. And the region has not really much changed in the past 20 years about wine. So they're all still very – Burgundy is all about wine producing. Not much has touched it. The iPad, no one cares about that in Burgundy. They're all about their wines.
iPads don't make wine.
Exactly. Now, Aubert de Villanay is the co-owner of the Domaine de la Romanée Conti Vineyard in Burgundy. And during this time, he received a very ominous letter to his home address. Upon opening it, he immediately realized it was a ransom note of sorts. The letter demanded 1 million euros, or all the vines of the Romanée Conti vineyard will be poisoned.
Oh.
Scandal.
Okay.
The letter
is kind of scandalous.
Yes. The letter also mentioned that two of the coveted vines had already been poisoned. Aubert didn't take the letter very seriously, but then a second one arrived not too long after with the same message. And he decided this couldn't be a joke, right? One letter, maybe? Two letters? I don't think so.
I mean,
do the French even joke about wine like this? No.
Oh.
So the second letter arrived, and in the second letter, the writer provided detailed knowledge and maps of the Grand Cru Romanée Conti vineyard, the DRC monopole, which, if you're not familiar, is the area that the vineyard controls in the region, so not just where the vines are, but the entirety of the land that they own.
Yeah.
Some of that land does not have vines on it.
Yeah.
So they're like, I know the exact region of where your vineyard is. And they also threatened, again, to pour poison all over the roots. They mentioned in this letter again that they had already poisoned two vines, you idiot. And they're like, this is how serious we are. So he's like, okay. And then the second part to the letter, after he unwrapped the letter, there was another piece of paper in there. And inside that was a map. And the map had X's on two locations where the vines they had poisoned were.
Okay.
Now, the second letter was also really interesting because the writer clearly had some sort of understanding or knowledge of winemaking because they used sophisticated terms like décodelonvenage, which means stripping or filtering, and démontage, which means removing the sediment.
Okay.
So they used these like words within this letter and it kind of tipped the reader off like, okay. They have a very detailed understanding. That's something that a producer would know, not necessarily the layman.
Yeah.
The owner of the vineyard immediately contacted the police this time, but they wanted to keep things hush-hush because if it got out that they were being blackmailed, then this would give other wine producers kind of like an opportunity to take over and be like, well, do you want possibly poisoned Burgundy wine?
Yeah.
So upon arriving at the vineyard, they removed some vines to test them, which was in the locations that the X's were, just to see if they were actually tested. And upon testing, it was determined that they had been treated with chemicals.
Okay.
They noticed that the other vines around the two poison vines also had holes drilled into them. But there was no detection of chemicals. Now, this is a common technique used to kill trees, used to drill holes into them and let nature do its thing. So the blackmailer had used a syringe to inject poison into the roots of the two vines that were poisoned. This was an especially significant detail because over the centuries, vigneuners, which are the people who take care of the vines, have used this syringe technique to inject liquid carbon disulfide into the soil to kind of save vineyards from infestations by phylloxera insects.
Okay.
So obviously it's someone who has worked at a vineyard.
Yeah.
And knew exactly where to inject stuff.
Yeah.
Safely to inject chemicals.
Safely, yeah. Safely to poison.
Yeah, exactly. So they're like, oh, this is where we inject it safely to get stuff up the roots. So obviously poison would work here too.
Huh.
So their very methodology had been used to preserve these vines. Now they're employing it to kill, so they're like, it has to be someone in the wine industry. They decided to set the blackmailers kind of off and agreed to the blackmail exchange.
Okay.
So they had De Villeney write back, setting up a ransom drop in a cemetery nearby on the night of February 22nd. Within 3 days, they had a reply from the note, and the tone of the note was extremely different. Almost overly polite, super grateful, said thanks a whole bunch, like very strange. As they waited, they told the owner to go about his business as normal and not to raise any suspicion. So he went off on his trips, came back, was doing his regular business hours.
Yeah.
The police then hatched their plan. There would be about a dozen armed police officers hidden about the cemetery. There was a bag full of fake gyros inside there. There was a tracking device that would be activated when the bag passed sensors that were embedded into the ground at the cemetery gates.
Okay.
So once they knew the bag moved, they were on it. No more than 30 minutes after the drop time, the police announced over the radios that they had nabbed the man.
Wow.
The man's name was Jacques Solti, and he was in his late 50s, along with his son Cedric. I think he was in his early 20s. They didn't really state his age. The DRC had not, like, really understood who this person was or how he was connected.
Yeah.
So he had not only marked the DRC for destruction, but he had also simultaneously orchestrated a similar plot against another highly regarded vineyard
what?
In the area.
Okay.
So he also targeted Domaine Comte Georges des Vosges, which was in a separate area of Burgundy, but similar wine producer. Police discovered this because the first package mailed to De Villeney had a Paris postmark. And so they went to the post office and looked at the footage from surveillance cameras, and it revealed that he had shipped another package at the same time that looked exactly the same.
Okay. So he it was simultaneously mm-hmm. running so, yeah. on some... Okay. Oh.
So they contacted the owners of the other vineyard, and the vineyard, too, said that they had lost two of their vines to poison.
Oh, shit.
So when Solti had been, like, taken in, they kind of asked him, like, okay, so what's your connection to this? Why are you interested in this? So he went on and told his entire fucking life story, okay? So when Solti was about 12 or 13 years old, his parents sent him to the Lycée Victoire de Bouin, which is a boarding school that specializes in winemaking.
Okay. Of course, France would have, like, a boarding school that's, like, but also winemaking.
Yes.
Wow.
Which is also a thing, like, for culinary school. Like, they would send chefs to boarding schools like that, too.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, when you're talking, like, kids, it's, like.
It's trade, you know?
Yeah.
Learning the trade.
That's true.
Now, according to the principal of the school, they said that they had a file on him. And within that file, it was a lot of, like, infractions. His grades were terrible. His parents, too, were winemakers. They oversaw a really small vineyard. And he was very troubled from the start. So they sent him to boarding school. And while he was there, he was also very troubled. It would only be a couple months before he got expelled for the first time.
God.
He'd come back. But, you know, he kept getting sent away. His offenses were things like smoking, cursing, staying up all night, but also like destruction of property, like just being an overall asshole.
I was hoping that it'd be something crazy like peeing in the wine bottles.
I mean, I wish, but no. He also, after being finally taken out of the school officially, he committed a string of armed robberies after this and even attempted a kidnapping.
Whoa. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
During one of the crimes that he committed, shots were exchanged with the police, and he actually ended up being hit in the chest with one of the bullets. He was fine, and he did get sentenced to 20 years in prison.
Of course.
He'd only serve a portion of the time, and he would be in and out of jail for a vast majority of his adult life.
Wow.
So he decided to switch his business to extortion instead of robbery.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit safer.
Definitely. Definitely.
Less chance of getting shot.
Yeah, I would say so.
And also using his knowledge of wine to kind of psych these wine people out.
Interesting.
So he set up a shack in the woods overlooking the vineyard area in Burgundy. He lived there with his camping kitchen and poison laboratory.
Police, oh my God.
Yeah. Police located the shack and found in it syringes and Roundup.
Oh.
So he was using the chemical Roundup to kill the vineyards. Slowly, word of the crime leaked into the French press. The DCR was concerned about copycat criminals. So the trial was kind of, they were apprehensive to take it to trial. Mm-hmm. They never would get to trial. Because in July of 2010, Jacques Zolti was found dead in his cell.
Oh?
He had twisted his clothing up into a rope and hung himself.
Oh, boy.
His son, Cedric, would go to trial on, you know, very quietly on the down low. And the judge gave him time served for being an accomplice. So he only served 8 months in prison. So they just kind of like...
Yeah, done. Yeah.
But sadly, this would not be the last of the problems for the Domine Conti. Next would come wine theft and a little bit of fraud.
Oh, boy.
Now, we're going to go back to the early 2000s to kind of set you up with this particular part of the story. This is when a wine boom was happening. Mm-hmm. California wines were taking the fuck off. There was a run for the money for wine. This was also a tech boom. Silicon Valley was like... growing. So all of these men with all of this money were like, what do we need? Rare vintage wines.
Of course.
So rare vintage wines were going up for auction and being sold through establishments like Christie's Auction House and Sotheby's. And a man named Rudy Kernawan began to be coming like this sort of like Los Angeles scene wine selling douche canoe. Mm-hmm. Just like typical, right? Yeah. Typical California guy. In one auction at Acker, Merrill, and Condit in 2006, Kernawan sold $24.7 million of wine. He beat the previous record, which was $10 million. He then began to focus on rare French wines like the DRC, and he even became known as Dr. Conti because he was, like, so in it.
Oh, God.
It wasn't until 2010 or 2012 when things started to take a turn. A collector of wine named Bill Koch, and yes, Bill Koch is a Koch brother, started to take note on some discrepancies. He found fake bottles of wine in his collection and decided to hire a private investigator. Now, in an interview later for a documentary called Sour Grapes, Koch stated he hated to be cheated. Which is really rich, considering who the fuck his family is.
Yeah, right.
Now, rich people buy wine from auctions and dealers all of the time. They're not normally the ones doing it. They're hiring someone who supposedly knows what the fuck they're doing to buy these things for them.
Yeah.
But it's not that uncommon to find fake bottles of wine in their cellar. They act very shocked, but it's like, when you got money to throw away, who the fuck cares?
Yeah.
You know, the shocker, though, is that they're buying them mostly from auction houses that are supposed to have done their research. So places like Christie's and Sotheby's, they should have provenances for all of the things that they have.
Yeah.
But apparently faking provenances for wine isn't hard.
No, it is not.
Obviously, the people who are like the independent dealers, you would expect that more because they're making direct quick cash from this.
Yeah.
But a lot of these people are buying from auction houses and getting swindled.
Yeah. And they aren't, I mean, there is definitely a way to check with the producer to be like, hey, did you produce this?
Oh, just wait.
This wine. Yeah. This is one of my, I love this so wine fraud story.
An example of this is a bottle of Clos de Saint-Denis from Domaine Poussant was producing wine between 1945 and 1971. The head of the house found it very interesting that he was seeing things in the paper that stated that there was a wine vintage in 1982, which is like, we stopped producing that particular wine in 1971, you fucking morons. So He saw that, and he also hired a private investigator to investigate these fucking fake wines.
Yeah.
So you have Bill Koch, rich old white guy. Laurent Poisson, rich old white guy. Hiring private investigators because they got swindled out of a few million, which is like pennies to them.
Which also says something about the guy who's doing the swindling, right? Like, you couldn't take 5 minutes to go on Google on your brand new iPad.
Right.
And search, like, so-and-so 1982 vintage.
Yeah. Duh.
It just seems so obvious to me.
Yes. Like, that one was so dumb. I can understand. The other thing that happened was people were finding, so sometimes they number bottles. Mm-hmm. So people were finding that there was a wine that was produced in the correct years, but it was a number bottle that was not in the number range that they had bottles for.
Yeah.
So like they produced like 500 bottles of wine. It was like a 700 number.
Yeah.
It's like, we didn't produce that many bottles of this wine that year. So
wrong. Yeah. Jeez. Google people.
That's harder to figure out. Like, true. Sometimes they don't tell you the exact number of bottles that were released.
Sure. And for this reason.
Sometimes they're like sample. That are not numbered. Those are the rarest. Those are like the first pulls.
Yeah.
But those aren't sold to the public generally because it's the first pull just to test it.
Right.
So authentication experts determined that there were lots of dodgy consignment and provenance paperwork within all of these fakes that they were investigating. And it was enough to get the FBI involved, as the money from this added into the millions, closing in on the billions.
Mm.
So once you're fucking around with this much money,
rich people,
you gotta call
shit,
the FBI
man.
In.
Rich people shit, I'm telling you.
In March of 2012, they set up a sting operation, and their eyes were on Rudy Kirwan, who had sold the largest bit of wine that we just saw. He was making a huge name for himself, so they're like, we're going to look into this guy because that's a little bit suspect.
Yeah.
They raided his home in California and found the motherlode. They found a fully equipped counterfeiting workshop complete with corking tools, labels, empty bottles, and extensive tasting notes. Kirwan had been taking cheaper wines and putting them into more expensive bottles, and also altering bottles to appear more valuable. So, like, changing the numbering on them, or taking a vintage that was actually produced in 2005 and saying it was, like, a 2003 because that would make it older.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of filtering and altering and doing all these weird things. Kirwan was the only person in the U.S. history to be tried and convicted for wine fraud.
Yeah, buddy.
After a short trial, which lasted between December 9th to the 13th, he was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. His arrest led to another wine fraud ring being broken up in Europe, which was led by a father and son duo out of Italy who were committing wine fraud across Europe during the very same time period. When Kirwan was caught, this made the DCR vineyard very suspicious. So they went to the authorities and tipped him off and said that they believed that more fraud was being committed than just that one man, which is how that additional ring of people got caught.
Gotcha.
They recovered at least 400 bottles of DCR wine and found connections to the ring in 20 other countries.
Yeah, that's wild.
According to the Sour Grapes documentary, as many as 10,000 fake bottles of DCR wine are estimated to be in private collections to this day.
Yeah.
So if you want to find out more about wine fraud and the DCR's fraud in general, I would highly recommend watching the documentary Sour Grapes.
It's super good.
Yeah. I think it's still on Netflix.
It is, yeah.
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 So that is just some. I mean, there was another ring recently that came out with not just their bottles of wine, but like a bunch of French wine.
Yeah.
I didn't include that because it's literally a whole nother story.
Yeah.
There's so much wine fraud.
That is like that. And that one about good old Rudy is like one of my favorite wine crime type things because or like food crime or like the sort of like crime of the aristocrats, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's this really bougie shit.
A burgundy collar crime.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. Very
thank
nice.
Thank you.
Because it is so weird, and the guy kind of just shows up out of nowhere. Like, really, he showed up on the scene out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And just started making these connections. Like, very Anna Delvey-like, except less of a bitch. Like,
I mean, we don't know.
I mean, true. But, you know, that same kind of, like, pretension and, like,
oh yeah,
just like inserting himself
into
the scene.
It's so not hard to swindle rich people. We've seen it time and time and time again. They're so gullible and lonely and stupid.
And they don't want to admit that they're wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then when they are wrong, they're like, fuck me. I want my money back. You know, like full on Karen.
True. Oh my God. Okay, so I don't think that we've ever done like specifically a French episode or like
I don't think
like
so
a France mm-hmm. episode. But my first thought was like, it's France. There's probably a lot of weird shit that happens out there, like crime wise. Mm. And they do. I definitely saw like a couple stories, especially old timey stories of like cannibals that were assumed to be werewolves in like the 1500s.
Oh, yes. We definitely touched on something like that when yeah. we did the story. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And I was like, ooh, that might be kind of good, you know, like you do in the old mm-hmm. European times. But I came across this gem. It's French. It's art. It's crime.
It's French.
I wanted to talk about the guy who has been dubbed the most prolific and consistent Ooh. Art thief ever.
Yes.
Stefan Breitweiser. Wait. Breitweiser.
Ooh.
I'm going to say it regular, though. I can't do that for a whole episode. So
it's fine.
Breitweiser was born in 1971 in northeastern France. His mother was a nurse. His father was a sales exec in Switzerland. And his upbringing is definitely described as being like kind of bougie.
Yeah. His dad's working in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Which is and like crime capital of the world.
It's like where he's at is right on the border between France and Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So this is from, let's see. Oh, there's this great article in GQ. So this is from that article in GQ. Quote, the family for most of his youth was well off, living in a grand house filled with elegant furniture, Louis XV armchairs from the 1700s, empire dressers from the 1800s. End quote.
Not empire like our empire.
Empire.
No. All the Midwesties know what we're talking about.
He had gone to university to study law, but dropped out after a few years. When he was 22, Breitweiser's parents' marriage just like imploded. It ended horribly. And as GQ put it, he and his mother tumbled down the social ladder. His father kind of took everything, like all of the nice shit, and they were like left with just like nothing, pennies. It was around that time that Breitweiser met Anne Catherine Kleinklaus, who shared his love of museums, and the two quickly became a pair. It wasn't long before she moved in with Breitweiser and his mother. Now, the couple decided to visit a museum in the French village of Tann, where Breitweiser sort of first had the urge to steal something.
My first urge to steal was penny candy out of, like, the Brock's candy display. So, like...
Yeah, no.
I was like, I want that Werther's. I'm going to take it.
They stumbled upon an antique pistol... hand-carved from around 1730.
How cliche.
It reminded him of some of the weapons that his dad actually had, like these old antique weapons.
Of course he'd collect weapons.
But far nicer than anything his dad had.
Right.
And he wanted to take it. The museum had little security and the display case had been left partially open.
My God, stop.
So Breitweiser decided to take it, which opened the world to hundreds of thefts to come.
Oh my God.
And a lot of this like early day stuff is according to Breitweiser himself.
Mm-hmm. So it could be totally fabricated.
Yes. A lot of this has been backed up, but like some of the things are like, meh. So later in March 1995, Breitweiser and Kleinklaus visited the medieval castle at Gruyères, Switzerland.
Mm.
Yes, like the cheese.
Excellent cheese, yeah.
There, 22-year-old Breitweiser stumbled upon a painting by Christian Wilhelm Dietrich and an 18th-century German artist. It wasn't really like a famous piece. Mm-hmm. It was only worth about 1,500 pounds. I mean, it wasn't like something crazy. But Breitweiser was taken with the piece, later saying, this is from The Guardian, quote, I was fascinated by her beauty, by the qualities of the woman in the portrait, and by her eyes. I thought it was an imitation of Rembrandt.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You see, Breitweiser was not interested in, like, the wealth that he could accrue by stealing all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Instead, he lifted the pieces that spoke to him, that he like saw beauty in.
Of course, that's the most fucking French thing I've ever heard in my life.
Right? Because he wanted to add them to his personal collection.
Oh, sure.
Which, you know, of course, it's like this dude, Breitweiser, who was literally working as a waiter in Switzerland. Like in his regular life, he was like a garçon. right? In Switzerland. Very nice. Thank you. He just decided to embark on this still ongoing career of stealing art and rare antiques for his personal collection, which he held in secret at his mother's flat. Like, they talk about him not having enough room for this stuff, and it was just piles and piles and piles of...
That's when you have a problem.
No.
It's not a collection. It's a hoarding situation.
I don't have a problem. I have the most expensive collection in all of France.
Right? You just have nowhere to put it.
So following the theft of the antique gun, Breitweiser visited the Museum of Musical Instruments in Basel, Switzerland, where he stole a 17th century violin, followed by taking a painting called Two Men by Antoine Watteau from the Museum of Montpellier in South France.
Accidental accent.
So this continues on and on and on. And I'll go a little bit more into depth about like what he had later. But this goes on and on and on until one day in November 2001, when Breitweiser climbed a radiator at the Richard Wagner Museum in Lucerne, Switzerland, to steal a bugle from the 1580s.
Of all the instruments, a fucking bugle.
And it's more, I'm sure it's more of like a horn, like a... Mm-hmm,
like French horn style?
Yeah, because it's from the 1780s. It's like, you know. Upon returning home, his girlfriend, Kleinklaus, was not happy, mainly because they had already been caught in Switzerland one time. And they were allowed to leave on a suspended 8-month sentence in Switzerland, but they were essentially banned from coming back into the country. So she was like, yo, we cannot steal from Switzerland anymore.
Yeah.
He's like, cool, but I'm going to go into Switzerland and steal this bugle. And then
never
just
listens.
Came home with it. So they decided to go back to the museum thinking that he had left a bunch of fingerprints behind. She went with him. to erase the like with like rubbing alcohol and like a cloth to erase the fingerprints off of this display. So she goes in, leaves him in the car, which he then gets out and is like walking the grounds. They should not. It was a total mistake to go back.
Oh yeah, 100%. You're already a different fucking place. Like no,
yes,
no, don't go back. Don't ever go back.
No. And they did hit
not
a lot
for
of
crimes or horror movies. Don't ever go back.
A lot of these museums, they hit multiple times. Not like one right after another, but like after a
period
of time.
One and done, always. Yeah. Don't ever go back.
There's only so many museums in Europe, though.
There's actually a lot of museums in Europe.
I know.
It's like where all the museums for art are.
So they go back. He's walking the grounds. Turns out someone at the museum recognized Breitweiser and called the police.
Whoa.
Shocker.
We do. So like when I worked in a museum, we did have like a photo like list of people that were not allowed back in there. But it was like in a binder and you'd have to like look through it.
Yeah.
To see who the person was.
Hold on, let me check.
I imagine
you're not
in like a smaller museum, yeah. But like in a larger museum, they probably have like a computer system or something.
So that's the thing. He was walking the grounds. There was a like a regular patron at the museum who was walking their dog. Saw this guy kind of acting suspiciously. I believe I saw someone somewhere mention that he was wearing like a trench coat that was kind of like weird.
So how to tell that you're a criminal?
Trench coat. especially like trench coat in the summer.
Yeah.
Weird guys. Mm-hmm. So he went and told the cashier who checked out this guy and was like, hey, that dude looks like one of the three people that came to the museum yesterday. So there was only three people that had been there the day before when the bugle had been stolen. I'm going to call the police. So they called the police. Kleinklaus, like she had gone in to deal with the fingerprints and she was able to leave without incident because the two of them were not together. So nobody realized that like, oh, this is an accomplice or this is like they came here together. She just like drove off. She's just like,
nice.
Peace, drove off so that she could go tell his mother what was going on. So initially, Breitwiser opted to tell authorities that he had come to Switzerland alone looking for a gift for his mother for Christmas. And while he had
a stolen bugle,
he had taken the bugle. He just didn't know how valuable it was.
It's a museum.
Yeah, but it was just like sitting on the shelf. I didn't think anybody gave a shit because it's like nobody's looked at it. It looked a little dusty.
Classic.
But by the time they were like doing these interviews, his past criminal record in Switzerland had already been pulled up. Because his fingerprints are on file.
Yeah. And from all the crimes.
Yeah. And they originally were just like, okay, it's just like the small time guy. They definitely started taking him a little more serious because, you know, one is like small time. Two, even just two is like, this is a little more. Mm-hmm. So Swiss investigators managed to get an international search warrant for his home in France, but it took about 4 weeks to attain. Like, it just takes a lot longer. So this whole time, Breitwiser is sitting in a Swiss prison with no clue what is going on until he gets called into an interrogation room and gets presented with this photo of a commemorative medal that he had stolen from a different Swiss museum. Mm-hmm. Then they pull out all of these pictures. It's like a stack of pictures of all of the stuff that he stole. And he kind of realizes the jig is up, mm-hmm. confesses to everything. Breitwiser is like one of these people that has an incredibly good memory and was able to tell them everything he had, every single thing he had stolen, where, when it was stolen, where he stole it from, and where it's located at the house. And authorities found that in total, Breitwiser had stolen 60 paintings and 112 assorted rare objects worth between an estimated 1.4 and 1.9 billion pounds.
Oh my God. That's a lot of shit.
It's a lot. That's a lot.
You don't even have walls to hang that.
And I saw somewhere he was averaging stealing something once every 15 days.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, just the volume. That
is a problem. You're a klepto.
Yes, he is. So most of these works came from either France or Switzerland, but his stolen collection contained pieces from museums in the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, and Austria. Huge.
He's just missing Spain and Italy.
Here's where things get a little heartbreaking for the art lovers out there.
Oh, no. Did he cut him out of the things? No.
Before the search warrant was executed and Breitwiser confessed, his mother had gotten wind, likely from Kleinklaus, that he had been arrested. Her reaction was to chop up the oil paintings, which the old ones were done on wood rather mm-hmm. than on, like, canvas.
Yeah.
Shred some of the others, throw all of the other art objects into the Rhone-Rhine Canal. These included cheap profiting from his master by Peter Bruegel the Younger that was cut up with scissors.
Oh my God.
Sleeping Shepherd by Francois Boucher destroyed by garbage disposal. Madeline of France, Queen of Scotland by Corneille de Lyon, also destroyed by garbage disposal. And The Monkey's Ball by David Teniers, shredded by scissors.
God.
I know. And it's interesting because in some of these articles, they did some interviews with Breitwiser, and he had some reactions to the thefts of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Mm-mm. And he could not believe that these motherfuckers cut pieces out of the frames. He was like, I would never do that. The second you roll.
How did he get them out of there, then?
He picked
them up.
He primarily stole small pieces. Mm-hmm. Almost everything he stole, he could fit in a jacket.
Still in a frame. Those are pretty large.
Yeah. He was very, like, respectful and reverent of the art that he was stealing. So when he found out that his mother had destroyed all of this art, he was like, what the fuck, Ma?
Yeah, seriously.
Like, yeah. So some of the artifacts thrown into the canal were found by people who were just, like, passing by, who did notify police.
That's good.
They eventually had to drain part of the canal to recover as much as they could. Oh my God. They recovered because, like, the actual objects, like the statues and bugles and shit, mm-hmm. she just chucked into the river.
Yeah.
So they were able to, like, dredge all that stuff up and save most of it. And Mrs. Breitweiser did say she initially destroyed the artwork. She initially says that she destroyed the artwork out of anger, but authorities are like, we're pretty sure you did it to cover up the fact that your son had all this artwork in the house.
What'd she do with the frames?
I don't know. She probably chopped them up.
Oh, God.
So she got arrested also.
Funny if she kept the frames.
Yeah. They're nice frames. Well, and some of the stuff he had taken to, like, a local framer to get reframed, and the framer just, like, never asked any questions.
Oh, my God.
He just, like, never looked close enough. Yeah. So she gets arrested.
Some of those are hundreds of years old. How could you not? You're like, oh, how did you get a hold of this fucking 300-year-old painting?
Yeah. not my concern. Not my business. Breitweiser's girlfriend, Kleinklaus, was also eventually arrested and charged with receiving stolen items. So Breitweiser spent 2 years in a Swiss prison before being extradited back out to France to stand trial. He was still in love with Kleinklaus at the time, was, like, writing her from jail, but she had moved on.
Yeah, obviously.
Started a relationship with another man, and eventually the two of them had a child. Mm-hmm. And so he, yeah, that was over. Yeah. After going to trial in both France and Switzerland, Breitweiser received about 4 years in prison. On the day before his sentencing, he attempted to commit suicide by hanging. But another inmate found out and told the guards, and he was stopped.
Surprising. Okay. Mm-hmm.
After serving 26 months, Breitweiser was released. His mother was also found guilty for her role in destroying the artwork. She received a 3-year sentence with an 18-month suspension, and she served 6 months before being released.
At that point, you should just find her for the worth of the fucking paintings.
Well, that was the interesting thing in all of the sentencing. Like, his sentencing was not enhanced by the worth of the artwork. They mm-hmm. viewed the theft of the artwork the same way they would with, like, a regular burglary. It didn't mm-hmm. matter the fact that it was, like, worth millions.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure here we have, like, if it's under a certain amount. It's
yeah,
like
it gets enhanced based on the amount all the way up to, like, you know. And plus, if you have, like, weapons, that's another enhancement. Yeah. So Kleinklaus also received 6 months in prison with a 12-month suspended sentence. And she served her 6 months and was released. While he was in prison, Breitweiser authored a biography called Confessions du Voleur d'Art, or Confessions of an Art Thief, that was published in 2006. So he was still in prison when this book got published.
Classic.
A German translation of the book was released a year later. Breitweiser served 26 months of his sentence before being released. And you think, like, this whole experience would turn him off stealing art and artifacts, but he went right back to it.
He had a problem, obviously, if he stole 180-some pieces. Yeah.
And he was declined of their beauty in prison, don't you know? Like...
And because his mom chopped it up. Also that. Like, it was fucking porn magazine. She found it under the bed.
Also that.
This filth.
Yeah, she literally chopped it up and, like, got rid of it over the course of days in bin bags. Yeah. In April 2011, police conducted a search of his house, finding another stolen 30 stolen artworks.
30?
30.
A busy boy.
30, yeah. he was once again arrested and charged with theft, resulting in another 3-year prison sentence in 2013.
He should have been like, no, I stole those last time, so it doesn't count.
Yeah, double jeopardy.
Yeah, exactly.
This wouldn't be the end for him.
Oh, no.
Because police obviously placed him under surveillance in 2016.
Yeah, because he can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah. So he was under surveillance in 2016 when they had spotted a 19th century paperweight he was attempting to sell on eBay.
Idiot.
They recognized this.
Was Backpages still a thing? You should have went on Backpages.
Oh my God, true.
Backpages France. Yep.
2016?
Yeah, they stopped.
When was that?
They stopped doing it.
It was right around recently. That time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was in the U.S. I don't know if that goes for across the world.
Backpage is France.
Yes. Or at least like the, you know, the dark net.
Go to the Moulin Rouge. The dark web. No. Authorities recognize this as one of the items stolen from the Crystalware Museum in St. Louis, as in...
What?
As in St. Louis.
Missouri.
Like, yeah. Authorities once again searched his home in his native Alsace region, where they found not only the paperweight...
Classic.
But also Roman coins from an archaeological museum and other pieces from other galleries. They also discovered 163,000 euros in cash being kept in a bucket at his mother's house, which I'm like...
I'm sorry, what?
Which I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? You can't tell me that you don't know this bucket is there and full of money.
Mom, don't open the bucket. Don't open the bucket.
There's just poop in there. Don't open it. No, it's, I just.
Some mothers and their sons. I guess. They have a very unique relationship.
Yeah. So in February 2019, he was arrested yet again. I couldn't find the result of that trial. I can only assume it wasn't or won't be good. It's possible it hasn't happened yet because that's like mid-COVID years and like
and everyone a lot just of shit quit. Got
delayed. Yeah. So
like, we don't care about the justice system right now.
He's
pandemic.
Still, he's still out there like Stefan Breitweiser's.
Lifting coins.
And objects and paintings and bugles. And guns.
For the bugles.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this great, I think.
A paperweight. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a fancy paperweight. I think the article
paperweights are just failed sculptures. Doesn't everybody know that?
Aw, but they hold my papers down.
How fucking breezy is it inside?
Very,
but honestly,
very. Yeah. The article by GQ, I think it's the one by GQ, is really, really great because it has these very vivid depictions of him going in and stealing and how he did it super carefully. Mm. They talk about this one in the very beginning where he's like, watching the guards and seeing the patrons, and you go to a museum that isn't super, like, doesn't have a lot of foot traffic, and like, you take a Swiss Army knife so you can pop the screws out of it. Like, very interesting, but like, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
You just, it kind of reminds me of the egg guy, the guy who was trafficking eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just like, no, I'm still good. No, I'm gonna keep going.
Can't stop stealing eggs.
It's not going to stop.
Yep.
So, before
that's how you have a problem.
Before you go to France
and smuggle the cheese, I don't know.
check out this podcast.
I actually think you're allowed to take back a certain amount of food
and wine.
I think
you can, but how would you
declare it?
Oh, wine, yes. Food, like cheese.
There is cheese that doesn't have to be refrigerated.
Ugh, I don't want any part of that.
Yeah.
I want cold cheese.
Hi, I'm Lainey, host of the new podcast, We're All Just Pretending. It's a podcast that has elements of Dear Abby with a twist of Post Secret. Every episode, I'll read listener questions and provide advice and insight as a friend. My own pod friends will even join in and offer their advice on parenting, relationships, and even give you really bad advice on purpose. Since we all have secrets to share, there'll also be a segment focusing on letting the skeletons out of your closet. If you're looking for advice or want to share a secret, head to allpretendingpod.com. And remember, we're all just pretending here.
Well, some room temperature cheese.
Supposed to be room temperature. Yeah, like
yeah.
Brie.
Brie's, yeah,
Camembert, hello.
Yeah, but I'm not eating Brie every day.
I mean.
I couldn't eat Brie every day. Brie's really good.
Anything with a thick rind or wax treatment on the outside, you're not supposed to.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, I eat that every day.
No, I mean, almost.
Anything with the rind.
I'm more of a fresh mozzarella kind of a gal.
Have you ever made mozzarella?
I have. And ricotta cheese.
We were talking about making mozzarella.
They're very similar processes.
We should try.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of washing with brine.
Yeah.
Cheese talk. Ricotta is very easy to make, though, if you ever want to make your own lasagna.
I mean, ricotta doesn't have to be like in a ball.
No.
Right?
You have
it's just, it's like crumblies.
Well,
is it ricotta crumblies or
it's
no?
It's not crumbles, but yeah. It's soft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so like a spread.
Yeah. So with like mozzarella, it starts as that, but you just have to keep squishing it and squishing it and squishing it and draining it and squishing it and then washing and then draining and squishing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's end the podcast.
So
sorry that was cheese corner.
With Vicky and Chanel.
Dude, you have to know, as like two girls from the Midwest, we're like here for fucking cheese.
We
okay?
are so close to Wisconsin. We are practically cheeseheads.
Yeah. Practically. We're not
practically.
Though.
Practically. Only by taste.
Yes. Yeah. So that has been our show. We have, I think, one event coming up. We just passed Parapalooza. I'm sure we'll talk about it the next time we're recording.
Yes.
Because for here in the past, it hasn't happened yet.
Yes. We're time travelers. Yeah. We have another event, if you missed that one. Mm. September, probably the second weekend of September. We haven't got the exact date yet.
Not sure yet.
But we're going to be back at the Elgin Fringe Festival doing a live show. And you can get tickets and information at elginfringefestival.com, I believe is the website. You can get individual tickets. They start at like 7:12 or get festival passes. Then you can see everything. There's all kinds of shows, musicians, other podcasts. There's a bunch of plays. There's some dancers. There'll be an art show. Like, there's lots of stuff going on. All downtown Elgin.
It's always a good time.
You do have to, in case you haven't gone last year, you have to buy a button to get into all of the places, as well as a ticket or a festival pass. So don't forget to get your button with your tickets. They won't let you in otherwise.
Yes.
You can come see us.
Yeah.
Listen to us.
Woo-hoo. It'll be fun. It's always, I love working with Fringe. It's always a good time. Hopefully the weather is not, I know it's going to be July, but I'm hoping it's not like 150 degrees.
It's going to be September, Vicky. September.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking
event.
Oh my God.
Hopefully it's not rainy because you have to walk to all the places
to
get.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because it's all, it's all different venues in Elgin. So.
I think that's all we got right now.
That's all we have currently, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We might be taking some time off too.
Yes.
We want to just let you know that that might be coming up soon. Yeah. In October, we might be taking some time off. So.
Yeah,
we'll see what we have available. We might put out an episode. We might not.
Yeah. So the way it'll – so I think we've briefly talked about this when we kind of decided, because we have been running the show for 5 years. Now,
yes.
Right?
And we've never taken a break.
We have never taken a break. We always have something coming out on schedule.
It comes out during the week.
It comes out when it should. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the talk is we will not be recording the month of October, which means you will not be getting episodes the month of November, essentially.
Yes.
So just keep that in mind. There is going to be a little break for us, but we will definitely be back after that. We just got life things, you know.
Yeah, it's the busiest season for both of us.
It's
and
time.
Also, it's spooky season.
Yeah.
And I actually want to fucking enjoy it this time.
Yes. Yeah. And like we said, we've never taken a break. So,
yeah, never. I was like,
we'll be glad to have a vacation.
I'm going to float this idea to you because
I'm down for it.
I'm going to die. I'm going to be traveling. Yeah.
Maybe,
so much.
Maybe we'll have some things. We might have like some lost tapes or something coming out, but we might have some live shows, but.
Yeah, we're not too sure about how we're going to do that just yet. But
just so everybody knows, don't expect a lot.
Yeah, the end of this year is going to be quiet.
If you enjoyed this podcast, or I'm sorry, if you enjoyed this episode, you can
we know you enjoy this podcast.
If you made it this far, you can find more episodes like this at badtastepodcast.com, where you can also find links to our donate and merch page. Or you can contact us. Like, if you have an episode suggestion, we'd love to hear it. Just shoot us a little email on our contact page and we'll look into it. All right.
Can't promise a response, but we'll look at it.
On that note, our sound and editing is by Tim Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, the Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Mi amor.
Oui, oui.
Bye.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form or another.